Welcome to Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Podcast. This is the place to learn what Dave Ramsey and his team teach about leadership and business. My name is Chris Hogan, and I'm excited to host another great episode for you today. Now, today on the podcast, we're talking to Jay Papasan. Now, Jay and co-author Gary Keller wrote the best-selling Millionaire Real Estate series, and we're excited to have him on the podcast today to talk about their New York Times best-selling book, The One Thing, The Surprisingly Simple Truth Behind Extraordinary Results. Please welcome to the podcast, Jay. Jay, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks so much for having me.
Fantastic. Well, listen, I'm excited to talk to you because the book really intrigued me. First and foremost, you know, we're used to books these days that talk about the 27 steps we need to do, the 52 things. You come out with the one thing. Why just the one thing?
You know, it's just keeping it simple, right? As simple as it could possibly be. When Gary and I sit down to write books, the thing that we want most to make an impact on the reader. And the more we looked at it, the more we felt like we had to keep cutting away and cutting away. And the one thing just all boils down to one focus and one approach to everything that he's been successful in. So that's what we made the book about.
Wow. And you mentioned the phrase cutting away, because I don't think as business leaders and owners, we think about that a lot, you know, that there are things that we have to do, but we also have to avoid doing other things.
You know, it's saying no. In the book, we talk about every yes, a real yes, something that you're really committed to doing, has to be defended by a thousand no's. And the more I've been living this book over the last 5 years since we started researching it, I realize that that's the huge challenge, that it's not so much that you're unwilling to commit to something really big for your organization or your business. It's how willing are you to say no to everything else in between.
Wow. And Jay, you said we have to say no how many times?
A thousand.
That's a lot of no's.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I've been married for 14 years, and I remember when I said, yes, I do, in fact. And it was really clear. You know, people stay up for the night before. They have sleepless nights because they understand that they're making a bigger commitment. Mm-hmm. That in saying yes to this one person, you're in effect saying no to everyone else. And I don't think that we make business commitments the same way we make some of the commitments we do in our relationships.
Wow.
And that kind of willingness to say no to everything else, honestly, I've been working with Gary for over a decade now. I truly think that's what distinguishes him. He's smart, but he's not the smartest guy. He works hard, but he doesn't try to outwork people. He sees the priority, and he's willing to say no to everything else, as painful as that can be, to get that thing done.
And you bring up a point, because it does help you talk about the focus. Now, in the first few pages, you pose the question, if we all have the same hours in the day, why do some of us get so much more done than others? And I think that's a million-dollar question.
Well, you know, I think one of the lessons we taught people way back in The Millionaire Real Estate Agent was to think about your dollars per hour. And, you know, the people who are the wealthiest, I mean, Gary actually works less than a 40-hour work week. But if you looked at his dollars per hour, they're off the charts. And I'm sure Dave Ramsey is the same way. And I'm sure if I looked at your time, it would be the same way. The people who make the most money devote the majority of their time to the things that are absolutely the most productive. And it's just that simple. So it's not about how many hours you give it. It's about where you focus the hours you do give work.
Wow. And Jay, I think, you know, as people who focus and they're trying to get stuff done, they're not trying to make everybody happy. They're focused on what they need to get done.
Absolutely. I generally look at people being fundamentally wired in one of two ways. They can be very people-oriented or task-oriented. And I know that's very simplistic. Mm-hmm. But for the people-oriented, saying no to other people is a really, really tough challenge for them, right? They're committed to this. They have to say no to people. I tend to be a little bit task-oriented. So for me, when I'm really focused on one thing for my business, there's all these loose ends piling up. And in my mind, I'm very, very aware of them. And to quote the songwriter Beck, they're kind of being woven into a noose. That's my mental image, right? All these loose ends.
Yes.
And eventually, I kind of panic, and I go start focusing on the little stuff. and will get distracted from the big target. And that's kind of the battle you're fighting when you try to prioritize one thing above all others.
Wow. Now, listen, you also mentioned something in the book talking about the domino effect in a way that a lot of us are probably not aware of, and it kind of goes into that geometric progression. Can you tell our listeners about the domino effect?
Yeah, and if with your permission, I'll just give like the 30-second kind of summary that we just, you know, we've been talking around but not said of what the one thing is. The idea of the one thing is that in any area of your life, business, work, home, spiritual, physical, that you can identify the one thing that would give you the biggest results. And if you just prioritize that, you'll get disproportional results, extraordinary results. So that's the idea.
Okay.
And so what we want to have happen for people is a domino effect. And this idea that if you line things up, right, you begin with the end in mind and you work your way backwards and you just make sometimes really small incremental improvements. Maybe it's 30 minutes a day that you're practicing a new language. Maybe it's an hour a day that you just said, I'm going to make sales calls for my business. Maybe it's, you know, a commitment to wear a pedometer and get 10,000 steps a day. That when people make those commitments, that in the beginning, progress is kind of too small to measure, but it has a geometric scope to it. So that if you look out far enough, the results are bigger than people would imagine.
Okay.
And the example we gave is from a guy who had written a physics paper that said a domino, a little 2-inch domino, can actually knock over a 3-inch domino, and a 3-inch domino can knock over a 4.5-inch domino. That just the physics of it, a domino can knock over one that's 50% bigger. And if you look out at what happens if you lined up dominoes getting exponentially larger, I think it's by the 19th one, it would be taller than the Tower of Pisa. By the 23rd, it would be over the Eiffel Tower. By the 31st, you're 3,000 feet over Everest, and it's kind of mind-boggling. 57 dominoes with that sort of progression, it would almost bridge the distance between the Earth and the Moon.
Hmm.
And that's a geometric progression. Scientists call it the hockey stick graph because it looks flat, but then when you back up and look out, it just dances towards the ceiling towards the end. It's amazing results come at the end of it.
Wow. Wow. So obviously stay focused, pull out, look at it, and still stay, you know, try to get stuff done. Now, nobody's going to just push back or doubt the importance of focus, but for a small business owner who survives by multitasking, how do they begin to put this into effect?
Well, you know, I mean, multitasking is one of the lies we identify in the book, and it's a natural reaction. When you have too much on your to-do list, when you have too many things on your calendar, and you know what matters most, the first thing most people try to do is, well, I'm just going to do two things at once. I'm going to knock out two birds with one stone.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with multitasking is that it's really impossible. We kind of went on for about 14 pages in the book, but the three things that we really positively identified is that it slows you down. When people switch between two tasks, because that's what's really happening, you're just bouncing back and forth really rapidly. On the low end, we lose about 28% of our workday to multitasking. So if you've got two screens and you're doing work and bouncing to emails and phone calls, the time cost for you is more than a quarter of your day.
Really?
You're working. In 5 days, you're working a 4-day work week.
Wow.
And if you could eliminate that, just think of the benefits to your business by just focusing on one thing at a time. The second one is it costs you effectiveness. There was a guy who did a study. He got all these graduate students together and grouped them by people who could really multitask well and who could, and low multitaskers, people who said, no, I just don't do it well, and gave them a battery of tests. And at the end of it, what really surprised him was that on every single measure, the low multitaskers did better. And so people think they're doing things better, that they're great at multitasking. My wife used to brag that because she was a woman, she was better. But in effect, they're just monkeying around. They're not actually doing anything better. And the funniest kind of results that we saw from that, there's a guy in King's College that for his PhD compared the IQ results from three tests. If you give someone an IQ test that's focused, you get one result. If there are multitasking, you get one. And then the third result was if people were actually stoned on marijuana. What surprised people, and this is what, it was on the Huffington Post and all over the place, is that if you were multitasking, you were dumber than someone who was stoned. Stone people, on average, scored 6 points less, but multitaskers, 10 IQ points less than someone who is focused. And 10 IQ points, Chris, is huge.
Yeah, well, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have 10 to sacrifice.
No.
I need mine. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And people do it all day long, especially in the modern workplace. They bounce between emails and their tasks. They look at social media. And it's really making them dumb. It's taking up a lot of their brain power, and it's tying it up. And the third cost we try to share with the small business owners we kind of listen to is that it's proven fact, the more time you spend from to one task, the less likely you are to ever get back to the first. Hmm. And that's honestly how loose ends pile up in your life. You have all these unfinished things that stress you out.
It really does. That's amazing. I mean, and essentially for you laying that out there, that we lose almost 28% of our effectiveness by trying to multitask, that is a huge takeaway.
It's a big deal as a business owner. I mean, I can look at 5 employees and realize in terms of my cost, if I could just get them to stop multitasking, I would only need 4 to do the same work. Hmm. Doesn't mean you have to lay off the 5th. It just means that you can get that much more productivity of your team.
Right.
Here's the again, great days before noon. The reality is we're kind of hardwired to do this. If we hadn't been able to notice, right, the saber-toothed tiger sneaking through the grass while we were cooking up that buffalo, we would all have not evolved. You know, we would not be here today, that we're programmed to do this at a certain level. So we just kind of tell people, if you identify your one thing, just make a stand, whatever that thing is, to not multitask when you're doing it. I don't care if you watch the baseball game while you fold clothes, unless that's what you do for a living.
Mm.
If the key to your job is X, right? If you're a surgeon, I'm operating. We don't allow people, when life's at stake, you know, pilots, drivers, surgeons, they can't multitask when they're doing their job. I would tell everyone on this podcast that their job is no less important, even if lives aren't at stake.
Wow, I love that. Now, obviously, to be able to focus, it's going to take willpower. You have to be able to say no to some things, to be able to put the phone down. And I can tell you right now, when I'm scanning through emails or I'm reading or I'm writing, I don't do anything else. I mean, I literally will turn everything off and I am focused on that. But to be able to do that takes willpower. And you talk about in the book, there are some things that tax our willpower. And you mentioned in there, like coping with fear and doing some things that you don't enjoy. Can you unpack that for us a little bit?
Sure. I think, the first surprise for me when we really dove into willpower is that I didn't really understand it. I always thought it was kind of a character issue, you know, that, you know, where there's a will, there's a way kind of mantra.
Mm-hmm.
If I just grit my teeth and really bear down, I can make anything in my world happen. And the truth is, from a science angle, you need to start thinking of your brain as a little bit like the battery on your cell phone. And is that when you focus on doing the things that you need to do or saying no to other things, you're actually draining that battery. And the key to that is when you do your most important work and how you feed it. So all these things, you know, resisting the urge to go on Twitter when you're doing your budget, you know, not answering the text. You can feel that, you know, your phone vibrating in the background, but you know you're supposed to be doing your work. Saying no to those things drains you down.
Hmm.
And so the way it kind of made me and Gary really focus on modifying our behavior, one, your willpower is strongest in the morning. So again, go back to the beginning of your day. If you start your things with the things that matter most, even if they require a lot of focus, you'll more likely have it on demand. And the other is this active focus. When we say draining the battery down, you're really literally removing the sugars from your bloodstream. And they've done this. They've given people a test of willpower, like taking a multiple choice test that they don't want to take, right? It takes focus.
Yes.
Thinking about their will, an emotional thing, and they have to control their emotions, does that. Then they'll measure their blood sugar before and after, and you can see a drop. And then they'll give them another test, and people who replenish it will perform 50% better than those who don't. So I just looked up and I said, well, gosh, I don't need a lot of sugary drinks. I don't need things that'll make my blood sugar spike and then collapse. I need to have a good breakfast with, like, complex carbohydrates and proteins, things that will break down over a long period of time. Because I promise you, and you probably know this from working with Dave, if you work with top achievers, you got to bring it. I've got to be focused at work. I can't be off in la-la land because my willpower is gone.
Hmm.
So I'm looking right now under my desk. I've got a little bowl of power bars. I sometimes keep apples in my office so that I can actually feed my willpower throughout the day. And just good. Being aware of that, again, when I'm doing my one thing, I want to have my brain power to bring to bear so I can actually get it done.
Yes, I like that so much. Jay, the difference between living a balanced life and life as a balancing act.
Well, this is a really big deal because, I mean, you have a lot of leaders on this cast, obviously, and small business owners. And this idea that leading a big life is unbalancing is very true in our world because it's very hard to find that balance between your work life and your home life when you've got a small business to support, because at the end of the day, it's all on you. Or if you're the leader, you know, the buck stops with you. And so this idea of leading a balanced life, it's a really tough one for people. The way we've kind of tackled it, and Gary's kind of wisdom on the subject, is instead of trying to be balanced, where you kind of give everything equal time, is that to lead a counterbalanced life, meaning work is going to require you at times to go out of balance. And what we try to tell people is give work what it needs in the time that it needs it, but immediately go back and counterbalance. As an example of this, when Gary and I finished writing this book, and for a period of time, we were time blocking off our calendars for as much as 4 to 6 hours a day, and we had all these other businesses to attend to. So it was really stressful for us. For months and months, we were just, you know, locked away finishing our one thing. At the end of it, we both took time off. We went back and we spent extra time with our families. We went back and gave extra time to the businesses that we neglected, and we did it fast. And we did it in a regular fashion. And so the idea is that on the areas of your life that matter most, and it's not work, your family, your spouse, you never go more than a week or two without counterbalancing back and giving attention to those things.
That's really good.
The truth is, if you ask those things to wait, they may not be waiting for you at the end of the day.
Mm. Jay, you mentioned this counterbalancing. Well, how do you do that? Like, I know you say you go back and you focus on giving more time or spending extra time. Is that the type of thing that you mean with counterbalance?
It is, and it's just an awareness.
Okay.
I try to, you know, it's a part of writing this book. I tried to identify the relationships that mattered most to me. And, right now I've got two small kids. It's a big thing that I make a stand around two things with my work. I'm going to drop them off at school every day. I'm the working dad and have been for the most part. My wife now has her own business, but she's her own business owner. She can be there to pick them up if she chooses. It's hard for me. So I want to at least drop them off. I want that interaction at the beginning of the day. And I made a stand around being at home every night for dinner. If I have to get back on the computer after the kids are asleep, I'm okay with that. But I can't get this time back. So I'm just making a stand around regular time with them. They're small. I can't wait a month or a week and get back to them. So I try to make it every day. I get to spend time with them. They get my full focus and attention. And that's kind of the example of just kind of looking at your calendar and seeing the relationships in my life the time that they need.
Wow.
And, you know, I do that for myself as well. I try to plan out time for just me by myself, which I often, especially for working moms, is their last priority. And it's something that if they don't attend to, they're not going to be there to take care of these people that they want to take care of because they've neglected themselves so long they have a breakdown.
Yes.
And so just being aware of that, that you're paying these small prices and it will add up to something bad if you don't make regular investments as you go.
I like that. And it really comes down to really spending your time intentionally, extremely intentionally, so you can be there for your kids as well as your spouse. Extraordinary results come from asking the focusing question. Unpack that for us, Jay.
Well, because part of the book, because the one tool we want people to start doing, if there was one habit, is that in the key moments of their lives, they would ask this question, and we phrased it fairly intentionally, and Gary's been using it for years. It's the one thing I can do, such that by doing it, everything else would be easier or unnecessary. And this is a question that came from years and years of Gary coaching business leaders. In the beginning, he'd say, you know, on a coaching call, let's agree to what you're going to get done between now and the next call. And they would come up with a short list. Because these are leaders. They had knew their priorities. It might be four or five things.
Right.
And what Gary noticed was, is that of the four or five things, a lot of times they wouldn't do the thing that was most important. And he got frustrated. So he kept making it shorter and shorter. If there were only three things you could do this week, if there were only two things you could do this week, and it was almost out of frustration, if you could only do one thing this week, such that by doing it, everything else would be easier and necessary. Well, the moment he started asking that question, one observation, they almost always knew the answer. Almost knew exactly what it was they needed to accomplish. And two, when they only agreed to do one thing, there was no place to hide. They actually did it. Hmm. They couldn't say, oh, but I did this instead. You're just agreeing to do one thing. So it's a yes or no answer at the end of the week. Did you do it or did you not? And their results went through the roof just by knocking out their one thing. And so what we want people to do, and we actually, instead of, you know, most authors put all their promotional quotes on the back of the book. I mean, we just put a question mark. We want people to start asking this question right now. What's the one thing I can do in my business life, in my personal life, in my spiritual life, whatever context you want to give it, such that by doing it, everything else will be easier or unnecessary? The first part is the can do. It's not that you should do or that I could do. It's can do. I don't know if you've ever read Shel Silverstein, but one of my favorite poems is, you know, all the woulda, coulda, shouldas all ran away and hid from one little did. You want to ask your brain the answer for the thing that you can do right now, not something that you could do later or maybe. And you ask it that specific question, and the whole second half, such that by doing it, just means that there's more dominoes. You're doing something that's leveraged. By doing this, I'm gonna complete more than one objective. And when you ask that, people are really accurate. And if they do it, they really do see their results change.
Yeah, I mean, it clarifies things for you. And listen, you certainly put a question mark on the back of the book. I don't know what font size that question mark is, but it's huge.
Yeah, it's like 2,000.
It's exactly right. It stands out. But it gets people in, and you have to really drill down in this book because it's got so much stuff in it. Now, there's a great quote in the book from F.M. Alexander, and I want to make sure I quote this right, but it says, people don't decide their futures. They decide their habits, and their habits decide their futures. I was sitting and I thought, wow, I read it like three times because it's so profound.
I think it was Warren Buffett that said, you know, the habits of life are too light to be felt until they are too strong to be broken. And it's really what we want people to do by making a stand around their one thing is we're trying to get them to form habits. If you have powerful habits driving your work life or your health life, you actually can become almost unstoppable. Mm. I don't know about you. When you've read books on success and behavior change, when you heard how long have you thought it took to form a habit? Have you ever read anything about that in the past?
It's not as long as people think, is it?
Well, a lot of people I'd read in at least a dozen books, it was always 21 days to form a habit.
Okay.
And we went and looked at that, and it's completely untrue. There's a group out of Australia at the College of New London, and they did a study. They asked a lot of graduate students to write down a new health goal and to take it on. And then they followed them for a year, and they just did two things. Every day they would ask them, did you do your thing? And it might be, I'm quitting smoking, so it was something they didn't do. Or it might be, I'm going to drink 8 glasses of water a day. Or I'm going to start going to the gym or running. Whatever the health habit was, did you do it? And how hard was it? And what they were looking for was the point where the habit became as easy as it was ever going to get. And on average, that was 66 days. I don't remember when I read that study, I just sat back, and me and Gary talked about it for the rest of the day. Because for our life, we understood that you want your people to have powerful work habits, have powerful, you know, habits in their life. 21 days is just less than a third of the way through the work curve.
Yeah.
They're not establishing anything. They're taking their foot off the gas before they've gotten their job done. So, you know, we have a thing we're doing now called the 66-Day Challenge, where we ask people that have read the book to pick one thing in their life that they want to change, one thing, and to try to form a habit around it. And so for 66 days, to make the commitment of putting an X on the calendar and saying, I did it today, I did it today, I did it today, because statistically, in the 66 days, the likelihood that they'll keep doing it without any of the effort or as little as possible is really high. And boom, now they've got that extra habit. Maybe they're eating healthier or shopping healthier or going to bed earlier. Whatever the habit is, that's how it's done. Success is sequential. People like Gary, I look at him, even when I joined him, and he was working out, and he was eating healthy, and he was successful in business, and he knew how to hire people. He didn't do all those things at once. The reality is, he just focused on one habit, and this is in retrospect. He didn't know all of this when he was doing it, to be perfectly honest. He just go, wow, this is how it works, right?
Yeah.
He would just layer new habit after new habit. And then he becomes this creature of really powerful habits, and that's responsible for 90% of the success.
Now, listen, because I appreciate the time you've spent with us. I want us to talk about the iceberg a little bit as we wrap up. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, this is now getting into kind of the inspirational portion, right, of the book, but it's really important. One of the hypotheses that Gary went into writing this book with, and he's been teaching it for a long time, but we had to go out and kind of find some research to back it up, is that the most powerful businesses, the ones that are the most profitable, what you're seeing, all that profit at the top, you know, 8/9 of the iceberg is underwater. And for us, that was a powerful purpose, right? They knew why they were in business. That purpose gave them tremendous priority because we are out to change the world in, you know, electronics. Our priority is to build a better phone, you know, if you're Apple. And they focused wholeheartedly on that because it was really in alignment with their purpose. And that made them incredibly productive and therefore profitable. And so this idea that underneath all of it is this idea of purpose. And it makes a lot of people uncomfortable, but in the business sense, it's a little bit easier. You know, that's your mission statement, right? And I know one of the people that you interviewed, Simon, is it Selleck? I can't remember his last name.
Sinek.
Amazing.
Yes, Simon Sinek. Yes.
Sinek. You know, it's, people don't care what you do. They care why you do it.
That's right.
And that's one of the most powerful things for a business out there is this, this is why we're doing it and how it benefits you. And people engage in that. So as a business, it absolutely, we see tons of evidence. And I just tell people, the same works for you. There's a great book out there that, you know, this is some of the stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor, actually. And it was called The Happiness Hypothesis. And the metaphor he used in there for purpose is the idea of the elephant and the rider. Have you heard that story before?
Yes, I have.
I just love the metaphor because it seems to kind of make the light click on for people. And he said, if you've ever watched National Geographic where, you know, you see those little kids riding on the back of an elephant and guiding them through the forest, what we understand but don't often kind of think about actively is that there's an agreement here. The elephant is going where that small boy is telling it to go with a little bamboo stick because it agrees to go. If it wants to leave the trail and eat some fruit, there's nothing that little boy can do to stop the elephant.
That's right.
And the metaphor is your brain, what you think you need, is the boy. Your heart, what you truly want, is the elephant. And what you end up doing and actually committing to in your life, the things that you'll stick to on the rainy days, you'll get out of bed when you don't feel like it, you'll grit your teeth and make it through, the things that are powered by the elephant, the purpose, you know, your heart invested in it, those are the things that you're going to be ultimately the most successful over the long haul. So, you know, the base of the iceberg is purpose. And we just ask people to spend a little time as a business person or in their personal life to get in touch with that, because that's really how you bring leadership to your own life and to your business.
Jay, thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
It's been a huge pleasure for me.
Seriously, it is. The book is The One Thing, The Surprisingly Simple Truth Behind Extraordinary Results. You can also go to theonething.com. It's been an incredible opportunity to talk with you, Jay. We look forward to having you back in the future.
Thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Well, I want to thank Jay. I also want to thank our rock star producer, Don Haney. And remember to follow us on Twitter at Entree Leadership. And if you haven't yet, come over and join the discussion at EntreeLeadership.com. Remember, stay plugged into this Entree Leadership stuff. Keep learning and keep leading. Until next time, grow yourself, grow your team, grow your profits.